The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go, we have Rabbi Gershon Winkler. And I said that right, correct?
You said it correctly, even better than I would have said it.
All right, and we're gonna be playing in the background some of. You want to tell us what we're gonna hear in the background?
Yeah, you're gonna hear in the back. Well, it depends which one you're playing first,
we can start with Great Mother.
Great Mother. This is music by my beloved Rabbi Miriam Maron, who is a wonderful spiritual healer and a great musician and singer-songwriter. She's taken ancient Aramaic teachings from the Zohar and other sources from the Kabbalah that talk about God being the Great Mother, Ema Ila'a, and put it to music. And how the wings of the Great Mother always surrounds us wherever we are, wherever her children are, we are her children. And then there's another for a second piece is going to be what? Incantation?
Yeah, we'll play that after the break.
Yeah. Okay, great. One music at a time.
All right. You want to tell us a little bit about your history? Like how you became a rabbi, why you became a rabbi?
Well, I became a rabbi because they made me one. I didn't want to be a rabbi. I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be a cowboy and an Indian, and then I wanted to be a writer. I had many dreams as a kid, and I went to yeshiva. I grew up in a very Orthodox background, and went to Hebrew schools, the real Orthodox kind, which is the one where you are really deeply immersed in the ancient teachings in Hebrew and Aramaic, and then I went to Israel and after high school and continued studying because I just loved studying all this great wisdom. And the old rabbi there wanted to ordain me because that was the way we did it back then in the old days. You didn't go to like a rabbinical school. You went to a yeshiva. You studied for the sake of studying. And if the master felt that you were rabbi material, he would try to do that. I didn't want to be a rabbi, so I declined his offer. And then I went to become a writer and editor at McGraw Hill Book Company and all that. And eventually I got involved in teaching people who did not have a background in Judaism but wanted to learn more about it and realized that actually what I was doing on the side was rabbinic work. So I more and more got into it, to make a very long story short, and helped a lot of people study and learn more about their tradition. And then I went back to Israel in 1978 and said to the old man, okay, you were right, so initiate me already. And so he did, and I became a rabbi.
Now, you are not a traditional rabbi, though, are you?
I'm a very traditional rabbi, just not Orthodox.
Ah, okay. All right.
Yeah, you see, Orthodox is something new. It started like in the early 1800s, as soon as there was Reform Judaism, so everybody else was Orthodox, see?
Yeah.
My way of being a rabbi is being more like in the ancient times, you know, before we had denominations. So, you know, I'm just a guy hanging out and teaching. That's what rabbis do. We teach. We're supposed to be teaching, not just be CEOs of temples and congregations. We're supposed to be teaching people, inspiring people, making people laugh, make them cry, make them feel, deepen their connection with the spirit world and their soul and all that good stuff.
So,
it's a hard. It's very hard to define me. That's why people have been known as a flexidoxic rabbi. You know.
Okay, and how do more Orthodox rabbis treat you? I mean, are they okay with what you do, or?
I don't really hang around them, so they don't treat me at all. I wish they would. can buy me a coffee or treat me to dinner or something. But no, I don't really. I'm not. badly treated. On the web sometimes, you know, you would read something about me by the Orthodox rabbinate. That's not so nice because they miss me, because I used to be one of them. And that's how I grew up. And I also had two books banned by the Orthodox rabbinate in Brooklyn and New Jersey, Lakewood and Cleveland, everywhere. One book was about a woman Rebbe, a Hasidic woman Rebbe back in the 1800s, a real live woman that really lived and was a real, she had followers and everything else, and that was banned. And another book was called Dybbuk, which was about soul possession and exorcism, which is still in print, but in a revised edition that they revised because the original edition had too much explicit stuff in it that I just basically translated out of the original Hebrew. So it seems like the ancient rabbis or early medieval rabbis were more sexually liberated than the ones today in the Orthodox world. And sometimes even in all the other denominations. It's, so that's, I haven't been mistreated by anybody. You know, I used to get phone calls, you know, like years ago when I first left the community, I used to get like these anonymous phone calls where I would hear a rabbinic voice. I even felt the beard, and it would say something like, "Hi, I'm calling from the committee that knows. We know what you're doing. And please desist and repent and come back to the right way."
Okay.
So, you know, I would have a few of those, but I haven't had any ill reactions ever since. I think they just gave up on me and wrote me off as Meshuggah.
Well,
which is a very ancient Hebrew word for someone who's outside of the box, or just crazy.
Right. Okay. You dabble in you basically study a lot of esoteric Judaism as well.
Yeah, I studied a lot of Kabbalah when I was in the yeshiva world back in Israel, when I was an Orthodox young boy studying in the yeshiva, a teenager, and into my 19, 20, 21. I continued studying it because I fell in love with it. I used to hang around these old Yemenite rabbis. Yeah, rabbis just arrived from Yemen, sitting on cushions on the sand in Beersheba and teaching this stuff. And I was just so enthralled by it that since I learned how to read the language, later on when I became a little bit more mature, like last week, I think Tuesday, I began to study these books on my own and studied with teachers and just found so much richness there that I felt sad that it's not more known and more studied by more people of the Jewish tradition. There is so much stuff in there that smacks of Native American shamanism or New Guinea shamanism or Icelandic shamanism. It's amazing. I mean, you know, the meaning behind the sound of a bird's wings flying over your head, the use of a wolf's tooth for a certain healing ritual. I mean, there's so many wild stuff in this body of wisdom we call the Kabbalah, that even in the Kabbalah classes that people teach these days, they don't teach this stuff. They just teach this standard, you know, safe stuff that fits more within the mainstream of Judaism. And they never, they leave out all this great stuff about animal medicine and about the four winds, the four directions, and that we have in our tradition.
So would you say the Kabbalah is essentially a version of shamanism for Judaism?
Yeah, I would say that Jewish shamanism is a very integral part of Kabbalah, but okay. A part of Kabbalah that really isn't being taught in all these classes on Kabbalah around the country. And all these books written on the Kabbalah and they translated in English, you know, they don't really reach into those other works that teach about Jewish shamanic rituals and concepts. I mean, we have teachings about the underworlds. There are seven underworlds, and each underworld there are different beings that live there and different qualities that you can adopt when you do your journeys. There are shamanic journeys. I mean, there's so much stuff, which is what prompted me to write my book, Magic of the Ordinary, the recovery of the shamanic in Judaism, because people were, I was watching how my own people, Jewish people, were wandering off to Native American medicine people and wandering off to Peru to meet with Peruvian shamans and to have all these experiences and learn all this great stuff that we happen to have in our tradition as well, but nobody ever taught it to them.
Huh.
So that's why I began to restore this stuff, along with Miriam. You know, she's done a lot of this work too, and she's written a book also about the ancient moon wisdom in our tradition that just came out. And so the two of us have been giving workshops, retreats, invited sometimes by temples and stuff to talk about this wild stuff, but not a lot. And there's a lot of Jewish people who just have not been introduced to this part of the Kabbalah. People who have been studying Kabbalah for many years, but who never learned this part, because this part is not in the mainstream Kabbalah books that are out there, like the Zohar. This stuff is strewn throughout other books, like Seder Rosh Hashanah, and you know, the Mystery of Mysteries, the Book of the Pomegranates, the Field of the Pomegranates, Pardes Rimonim. Even in the Zohar itself, the Zohar is a compendium of ancient and early medieval Kabbalistic wisdom. And it's so strange that when you go to Kabbalah classes around the country, I've been, you know, I sit in on some, I talk to people who teach it, people who studied it. They just leap out certain parts that happen to be very shamanistic.
Why do you think they do that? I like to restore it to people. Why do you think they do that?
Because it doesn't belong. It doesn't belong. It doesn't fit with how Judaism has evolved over the centuries to what it has become today. It smacks more of something we don't understand what they meant. It sounds too not Jewish. I don't know why. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a fear of something that is strange to the mainstream party line of Judaism, which is a party line that has evolved over centuries of the people being in exile from land, from owning land, from living on the land, from being in nature. And so we've lost touch with that and instead have sublimated ourselves into a form of Judaism that is more a religion rather than a spiritual way of life that is filled with magic and the chirping of a bird. Some of these teachings talk about is the spirit of the bird communicating. I mean, there's so many wild stuff in there. If you look in the Mishnah, you know, the ancient teachings in Judaism, which is ancient mainstream teachings in Judaism, you will see that in ancient times our people used to bow every day. They would bow four times to the north direction, three times to the east direction, four times to the south, and twice to the west. There was an honoring of the four directions that we've totally lost in touch with, because we can't fit it anywhere. It doesn't fit, doesn't belong in a synagogue. It doesn't belong in the way Judaism has evolved itself because of its exilic, long exilic history. But now we're no longer in exile. We can go back to the homeland, or we can own land, we can live on the land, we can get back to this thing. They're no longer burning Jews at the stake. It's illegal in this country, at least. And they're no longer burning Wiccans, and they allow Native Americans now to do their ghost dance. So it's time for us, too, to come out of the woodwork and not be afraid to recover and to restore in practice these ancient ways. And whenever Miriam and I do retreats and workshops, we actually do these practices with the people, and the people are surprised. This is part of our tradition, bowing to the four directions, doing prayers to the four directions? That's not Jewish. That's Native American. I got to bring out the big heavy books and show them right there. It says, this is how we used to practice. There's an honoring, there's a mystery to each of the winds, of the four winds. And we have so many rituals about four winds that people are practicing even today in the Orthodox community, but they don't realize what they're doing. Like, for example, in the harvest season, when they take a lulav, an immature palm branch, and they're waving it to the four directions, into the sky, into the earth, and then into the heart, into their chest. And they have no idea what they're doing, or they're blowing the ram's horn, the shofar. You know, how many Jews who blow the horn on Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, realize that the ancient teachings about how the different sounds of a horn represent the different elements, air, fire, water, earth, and represents the stone beings that live on the planet, that with whom we share the planet. And the second sound represents the sprouting beings, the plants, the trees. And the third sound represents the animal beings, the wildlife beings. And the fourth sound represents the human being incorporating all of these beings. I mean, there's so much richness in these rituals. And people just go to hear the ram's horn be blown, but they have no clue. Nobody's teaching them the deeper meaning behind these things, because it just doesn't fit with where we are at. But it does. It's just that we forgot.
Okay. Wow, I just completely forgot the question I was just going to ask you.
See, I was talking about forgetting.
So how old is the Kabbalah?
The Kabbalah is very old. The Kabbalah is as old as the universe. See, the origin of what the Kabbalah evolved out of is an ancient mystery wisdom that really, honestly, has no religious denomination affiliation to it. Because it is believed that the Kabbalah, with all these great teachings, evolved out of early mystery schools that Abraham belonged to, Isaac belonged to, Jacob, and these were the mystery schools of Melchizedek, who was Abraham's initiator, according to the Talmud. Melchizedek was really Shem, the son of Noah, so it comes from this mystery school of Noah, the guy with the flood thing, and the guy that didn't know what a cubit was, remember? Bill Cosby record?
Uh-huh.
And then there, Noah got it from Lemech, who got it from Methuselah, who got it from Enoch. You know, so there's a whole long line of mystery school. It's so interesting that when one reads the Torah, the Hebrew scriptures, the Torah does not begin with Jewish people. It begins with God, who's not Jewish. And then begins with space, outer space, and the earth, and grasses, and plants, and trees who are not Jewish. And then with animals who aren't Jewish, and then it begins, and then people who aren't Jewish, like Adam and Eve, right? And the Mr. Snake, who wasn't Jewish either. And nobody is Jewish for generations, and these people are very close to the divine consciousness. There's a great mystery school that's evolving in the time of Adam and Eve, and then all the way down to Enoch, and then being transmitted to Methuselah, to Lemech, to Noah, all the way down, it filters down to Abraham. And so the tradition of the Kabbalah is a kind of a Jewish twist to what is originally and very ancient universal mystery wisdom shared by humanity, not by any one people, which explains why you can go to a Native American ceremony and feel comfortable as a Jew. Because there is a lot of similarities. You can go to a ceremony of an Icelandic shaman in Iceland, in Reykjavik, and you will feel at home as a Jew. And they, in turn, feel at home with us. When I visit prisons, and Native Americans come to my program, because they enjoy the chanting and the drum, they enjoy the teachings, they enjoy the stories, they enjoy the cosmology. We used to do retreats in New Mexico together with Native American teachers, because we found we had so much in common. There's a great book by Professor Howard Eilberg Schwartz called the Savage in Judaism, which is really it's out of print, but it's available on his website on an e-book because I made him do it. It's a great book published by Indiana University Press, where he translates the writings, the chronicles of the 16th century European explorers from France, from Holland, from England, and Spain, who came to the savage world, as they called it then, the Americas, and discovered something very uncanny. They wrote in their chronicles that the savages of the Americas have very similar traditions and outlooks in life and cosmologies and mythologies as the Jews, as the wretched Jews in Europe. And they dance wildly, and they chant like the Jews, and they have so much in common. It's amazing to read these chronicles that he translated from different languages from the 16th century.
And where is that available?
It's available on his website. I don't have it in front of me, but his name is Howard Heilberg Schwartz.
Okay.
And he used to teach at Stanford University, Judaic Studies. It's a book called The Savage in Judaism. If you just Google the Savage in Judaism by Howard Schwartz, you'll find it. You'll find it, and you'll find links. On my website, walkingstick.org, in the bookstore page, you will see the book there, and it'll give you the information how to order the e-book from him.
Awesome.
It's an incredible book, a wonderful masterpiece that he put together back then before it went out of print, filled with the similarities that has been discovered, not by us, but by people who didn't like us and people who maybe liked us a little, who were, anthropologists back in the 16th century and 17th century, how uncannily similar are the rituals of the natives of New Guinea, the natives of South America, Peru, and Native America up here, with the ways of the Jews. And the theory, there are many theories as to why this is, and one of the best theories is the one I always had myself, which is the theory by a French philosopher back in those days who said, this is because, you know, Judaism is a very ancient religion, and so are the religions of these so-called primitive peoples. And way back when humanity was one humanity, everybody had the same wisdom.
Hmm.
So basically, that's to answer your question. Yeah, the Kabbalah is the Jewish version, our particular Jewish version of what evolved in our tradition through our ancestors of what at one time was a universal mystery wisdom shared by all of humanity or most of humanity. And that's why you find a lot in common between ancient religions. Sometimes when I teach, all of a sudden somebody will come up to me and say, wow, that's really from Zen. I said, really? I didn't know that. That's how I was reading from the Talmud. You know, we have a story of a guy clapping with one hand, too,
huh,
in the Talmud.
Well,
you know, I think it was Rabbi Chista, who was found in the study hall clapping with one hand back in the 3rd century. And they asked him why, and he said, because, you know, you drove away one of my study buddies. You kicked him out of this school, so now I'm clapping with one hand. It's not the same as Zen, but, you know,
right.
Who cares?
Now, a lot of ancient cultures talk about cycles of time. What does the Kabbalah say about that?
Cycles of time, exactly the same thing. We have that too. It's called the Shemitah in the Hebraic word. So just like we have cycles every week, 7 days. It concludes with the Sabbath. Likewise, every 7 years, the seventh year is the Sabbath for the land. We're not allowed to work the land on the seventh year. The seventh year, whether you own land or not, your land belongs to the wildlife and to the poor and to the widows and the orphans and anybody who wants to come on your land to eat of the fruits. Every seven times 7 years, we have the Jubilee year. That's when all the debts are forgiven and stuff like that, and all slaves go free if you have a slave in the house, which you hopefully don't, because kana evet kana rabo. which is an old Talmudic saying that means if you acquire a slave, you've acquired a master. Because according to Jewish law, you're supposed to have the slave sleep in the same kind of bed you sleep in, the same kind of, eat the same food, and you got to take good care of them. If you hurt them, they go free, and they can sue you and all that stuff. So you have these cycles of sevens, 7 days, 7 years, seven times 7 years. So in the Kabbalah, they take that a little further, and they say, well, likewise, is the ages of the universe. There are many universes. There are many worlds. There were many worlds before Genesis, before Adam and Eve. They were pre-Adamic creatures and humans. See? So the universe is much older than Genesis. Genesis, the Kabbalah says, is the beginning of another cycle of sevens. Mm. Of seven what? Of 7,000 years. See? So right now we're in the year 5773 in the Jewish reckoning from whatever cycle we're in. And so we have another 200-some years to go before the end of the world. End of this world and the beginning of the next world. So there are, in the Kabbalah, this very radical teaching called the Shemitah, which is about the infinite cycles, according to one school, of 7,000 years each. And another school has it that it's actually 7,000 years seven times, and that we never know when the seventh is, and when the seventh one comes to its conclusion, that's when God retires.
Huh. Interesting.
And then we have all bliss and paradise and the world to come, and there are no more health insurance premiums, and you don't have to pay for cable anymore, and there'll be no more telemarketers.
Okay, and that of course lines up on some level with a lot of other ancient cultures. So many of them speak of cycles, great cycles of time, and cultures that
That's
go
right.
back way further than what we're familiar with.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really amazing because, you know, the concept of pre-Adamic human beings, you know, because, like, according to Rabbi Yitzhak Avakel, who was a great Kabbalist in the 13th century, in North Africa and later on in Sfat, he calculated back then in the 13th century, he calculated the age of the universe to be 13.5 billion years old. And that was back in the 13th century. And so his calculation was because he was of the school of this infinite possibility of cycles. And he believed that there was 7,000 years, and then there's 70,000, there's 700,000, 7 million, and so on and so forth. So there are a lot of teachings about the different cycles of the evolution of the human being and of the universe in general. Hmm. And then there are teachings like in the Zohar where there are seven cycles throughout the universal existence, and they are represented by the qualities of the seven underworlds, and that you begin in underworld number one, then you move to underworld number two, all the way up until the seventh underworld, where you meet the seventh gate of heaven and become completely spirit world after that. Okay. So there are so many different teachings about it, and it's wild and it's liberating and wonderful. It just makes the universe more magical, more mysterious, and it also helps you kind of crawl out of your own problems. Like, you know, everybody has problems. But when you remember that you're a little speck in the middle of a billion universes, cycles, universal cycles, you know, it doesn't matter as much.
But why do you think the number seven is so prominent?
Why seven? That's such a good question. Well, in the Hebraic tradition, seven is important because it represents a completion. In the Hebrew word for seven, sheva, is spelled in the same way as the Hebrew word for satisfied, soveya. Hmm. Just the vowels have been changed to protect the innocent. So you have so seven represents a completion, a full cycle. And based on the story in Genesis, and also based on the understanding of the particular sky beings that create the fullness the satisfactionness kind of our Earth. So in the Kabbalah of the sky beings, they are Mars, Ma'adim in Hebrew, and Mercury and Saturn and Venus and Jupiter and Sun and Moon. So these are called the handmaidens of Esther, of Queen Esther, and Esther is the Earth. Esther is Hebrew for the mystery, and Earth is mystery. And so, since the ancients believed that these particular seven sky beings gave the Earth its fullness, its satiatedness, and they then developed out of that the concept of seven, because they really believed that these were the only sky beings that really made the Earth what the Earth is, gave the Earth its life, gave the Earth its colors, its fragrance, its cycles, its seasons, and so on and so forth. And so there are teachings attributed to the qualities of each of these seven sky beings. And since there are seven of them, seven became the lucky number. Also in Las Vegas, I believe.
Well, okay, I guess so. And you say sky beings, these are different from the concept of God.
Yes, that's right, because they are God's creatures.
Okay.
Sky beings. I mean, there's. See, when you really study the deep, deep, deep Kabbalah, what it teaches is something very beautiful, that God does not exist, because God created existence. Hmm. So what we glibly refer to as God is something we cannot. What the mouth cannot speak and what the ears cannot hear. The only attribute of the non-existent God is what the non-existent God has chosen to reveal of itself through the magic of existence. So the non-existent God created existence, and existence is the only face of what we glibly refer to as God that God has chosen to reveal of itself. It does so. So people always create God in their own image and think of God as something within the universe, and God exists as we exist, and God breathes, and God gets angry and gets pissed, God has a period, and God has prostate cancer. I don't know what people want from this poor entity. Not even an entity, because God created entities. So the word God is such a loaded word in English, and in the Hebrew, we can't even pronounce the essence of it, because it's unpronounceable. Hmm. So that's why we have like what we call the Tetragrammaton, which is representative of the ineffable, non-peggable, undefinable mystery that brought existence into becoming, that called creation into being. And so the stories in the Torah and in the Hebrew scriptures and our own relationship with God is only with a little aspect of God that God has chosen to reveal of itself in the arena of existence. But we must always remember that God itself, in essence, is non-existence, because existence is created. God created existence, see?
Uh-huh.
So this will send a lot of people to the mental hospital. But it's not my... So sue me. What can I do? This is the Kabbalah.
This is
the Kabbalah they don't want to teach people, because it's too heavy. So they teach little nice things like there's Sephiroth, and there's a Sephiroth here, and another sphere there, here a sphere, there a sphere. Old MacDonald had a farm.
Now, the Tetragrammaton, if I'm not mistaken, that's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, right?
That's correct, yeah, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, right, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh.
And each of those letters actually has its own deep meaning to it, doesn't it?
That's right. And that the first three letters, for example, in the Kabbalah that they don't teach, the first three letters represent the three mothers of creation. That's the wording used in the oldest text of the Kabbalah, which we call the Sefer Yetzirah, the Sefer Yetzirah, which means the scroll or the book of creation. And there, whoever the author was, or authors, it's based on an ancient mystery school of our people. There, it says that the three mothers are Aleph Mem Shin, or Avir Mayim Esh, or air, water, fire. These are the three mothers that gave birth to the child of Afar, earth. So the three mothers is Yud Hey Vav. Yud represents the mother, the creator mother attribute of God, which is air, and Hey is the mother attribute of God, which is water, and the Vav is fire. Now the fourth Hey is what, I mean the fourth letter rather, which is the second Hey, is the child that these three mothers create, which is earth, which is us, here, right here. And so and it's known in Genesis as the lower waters. So the first Hey in the Yud Hey Vav Hey is the upper waters mentioned in Genesis chapter 1. And the second Hey is the lower waters, which is the unfolding of creation, of creation's intent. That intent being encrypted in the Yud Hey Vav, in the primordial air, primordial water, primordial fire. And it's important to note that by air, I don't mean the air we breathe. See, it's hard to say it in English. Avir, the word in Hebrew, we translate as air because that's how we experience it here as mortals. But avir, etymologically, is an ancient Hebrew word that basically implies a cleared space within which lies possibility. Wow. So every cleared space in the entire universe is avir. Every space that has the potential for creation to unfold therein is called avir. So in our world here, we call it air, but it needs to be taught that it represents something much more cosmic. And the same with the hay, which represents the second mother of water. It's not about the water we drink. It's the upper waters, which means the force in the universe that opens up the potential, that calls forth the dream, that challenges the possibility. That's what water does in our earthly sphere. It does that to seed, right? It softens the seed, opens it up, and calls forth the dream of the seed. And fire as well. Fire is a spirit fire. It's not the fire we burn. It's the fire of passion, of the creator's intent for creation to become, which then kindles the fourth letter of the Yud Hey Vav Hey, which then kindles the lower waters, which is creation responding to the intent and passion of the creator for creation to become.
So,
and creator, again, creator is important to note, that creator means not God. Creator means an aspect of God that God has chosen to reveal of itself, but is not all of what God is.
All right. We got to take a quick 45-second break. We'll be back in, 45 seconds with Rabbi Gershon Winkler.
Okay, that's okay.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, and we are talking to Rabbi Gershon Winkler. And we're going to hear in the background. Tell me about this second song we're going to hear in the background, Incantation.
This one is called Incantation. This is an ancient incantation for helping create balance and harmony between soul and body that we found in a very old Kabbalah book. And when I first chanted it, Miriam began to chant it with me, and then she began to create a whole arrangement for it, and she said she really needed to put it on a CD so people can really share with it. And people have been blown away by it. Even people who are not of Jewish faith who have listened to this one have been blown away by it and gotten into very deep meditative journeys with it.
Okay. And you want to tell us a little more about Marion?
Yeah, Miriam is the greatest person in the world. I love her so much. She's incredible. She's wonderful. She's a doctor, a PhD. She's also an RN. I think she has the only PhD in Kabbalistic healing. She's an amazing healer. People come to her from all over. She heals people employing the ancient tradition of our people, old Kabbalistic and shamanic traditions of the Jewish people that she has studied and that she has taught for many years, like maybe 23, 24 some years. She's a great mom. She's a great partner. She's an author of a great new book called Ancient Moon Wisdom, The Kabbalistic Wheel of Astral Mystery and Its Relationship to the Human Experience. Available now in paperback at your local bookstore, I hope. If not, you better say something to them. Why don't you have this book? And this book is based on her, the way she sometimes does moon readings for people based on the ancient moon wheel of the Kabbalah. And people have found it so uncannily right on with their life, with stuff that they're going through, and it has helped a lot of people. Not all of what she has done in that healing is in the book, but it's very beautiful, full of sources. That's one very important thing that we both of us do in our books is we always provide sources for everything we're saying, because people often don't believe, what? Judaism has that? No, it doesn't. Show me where. And we do. We show them. And she's a prolific singer-songwriter. She has 9 albums to her credit, and people can sample them on her website and see what else she does.
What is her website?
Miriam's Cyberwell.com. MIRIAMS CYBERWELL.
All right. Let's talk about something that we hear about a lot in the news, and it's kind of one of those hotbed issues. But what do these ancient teachings actually say when it comes to homosexuality, gay marriage, things like that?
Gay marriage is a horrible thing. I can't believe you're even bringing this up. It's amazing. You know, it's really I listen to the radio. You know, I cannot believe what people say. You know, well, the Bible says. Bible's where? Show me where! So, you know, nobody knows where to show. So those who know the Old Testament, as they derogatorily call our Torah, point to Leviticus, where it says, you know, a man who lays with a woman, and so on and so forth. And it is totally, completely out of context. Because that law in there against that prohibition against male homosexual activity is within the context of a list of things that we were not allowed to emulate of the customs of the cultic religious cultic customs of the peoples that were living in the land that we were coming home to. Of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Dolomites, and the Termites. We were not supposed to emulate their cultic ways. What were their cultic ways? Well, they would sacrifice their children. That's in there. And then male homosexuality. But it was a part of a cultic rite, meaning it wasn't about two gay lovers. It was about heterosexual people, you know, screwing each other as part of a cultic rite. That's what we were not supposed to emulate. It was so clearly stated in that context. In fact, a lot of people don't know because they don't read, they don't study, they just go by their own homophobic sensitivities. But in the Talmud, the Holy Talmud, written, you know, teachings by rabbis with long beards, much longer than mine, it clearly states that the Torah's prohibition against male homosexuality does not apply to anything, any homosexual activity other than intromission, which would mean sodomy. And so, like, there's any other way was not forbidden by biblical law. And this is reiterated in the codes of Jewish law of Maimonides, who was a very straight guy, extremely straight, more straight than me. And in his codification back in the 12th century, he also reiterates this, that anything short of intromission of between a man and a man is not a violation of anything in the Bible, at least not in our Bible. That's number six. Number four, again, it's very important to know that the entire prohibition appears in a list of things we were not allowed to emulate of the cultic rituals of the Canaanites. That's clearly the context. And people always take it out of context, like they take a lot of things out of context in the Torah, because of their own inhibitions and their own phobias about sex or about homosexual sex. There's absolutely nothing wrong in the ancient Jewish teachings in the Torah that addresses in any way two loving men making out with each other, making love with each other, and having a relationship. Period. Finished. I don't care what anybody tells you. And as far as lesbianism, the Talmud says, that's not even at all a question, they said. Huh. You know? So one rabbi then, in the second century, then argued and said, but it's lewd. So then the other rabbis overruled him and said, yes, but Miyasa Rahmana Pritza di Alma, which is Aramaic for, since when did the Torah forbid lewdness? See, so it's all about people's own sensitivity. I mean, even nudity is not prohibited by the Torah, but most Jewish people will probably say, no, of course, most religious people will say nudity is definitely a forbidden, not allowed to be naked in front of God, even though God created us naked. But yet, when you look at the actual teachings in the ancient law, which people don't read and don't study because they just stay with the party line that they're taught, you know, it talks about nudity very openly, that nudity is fine as long as it doesn't interfere with other people's senses, you know, in your own home, do whatever you want to do. And there were some rabbis who tried to legislate a missionary position in sex being the only legitimate position by Jewish law. This was back in the second century. And then Rabbi Yehuda Nasi overruled them all and said, it is the Torah tells you what kind of foods you're allowed to eat, what kind of foods you're not allowed to eat, but it does not tell you how to cook it. That was his response. And so the law was like he said, and then he reiterates, says any position goes, you know, as long as it's mutually consensual.
Nice.
So yeah, I think that the gay thing is so overly out of context by both Christians and Jews who really don't study their sources.
Okay. Now, what does the ancient teaching say about reincarnation?
Well, of course we reincarnate. I mean, well, it's not at all of mainstream Judaism, but in the Kabbalah, yes, in the Kabbalah, we do believe in reincarnation. That, for example, the soul is here to become realized, and everything that the Creator put in this world, for better or for worse, is there to help that soul, that individual soul, become realized in its own way. So if I go through life without tasting one potato blintz, one knish at a deli, my ass is going to come back here again. I have to come back. Because as soon as my soul leaves my body, it's going to feel like it missed something that God put on this earth, a potato knish, and I didn't take advantage of it. See? So we come back here to realize parts of our soul that it did not take advantage of while it was here. Because God doesn't like complainers. You know, because the moment we die, the soul begins to feel everything. Oh my God, it begins to say, oh man, I should have, oh, I wish I, oh man, I,
I wish I would have written back, I should have called. And then they come closer and closer to the heavens, and God says, well, who is that? Who is that? Give me a headache. Send them back. That's reincarnation in Judaism.
All right.
We have a whole book on reincarnation in the Kabbalah written by the foremost disciple of Rabbi Isaac Luria back in the 16th century. Isaac Luria was a great Kabbalistic master, and his disciple, Chaim Vidal, he wrote a book called Sha'ar HaGilgulim, which means the gate of the wheel. And that's what we call it in the Kabbalistic language. Reincarnation is called the wheel. It's a great book, and it talks about the reincarnation and how different parts of us reincarnate. Not all of us, our soul reincarnates. It doesn't have to. So the part of our soul that has been realized stays put, while parts of our soul that has been unrealized and unsatisfied goes back into the world and is born into a family that owns a deli.
Okay. There's a mention in I guess the Old Testament, the English version, of a group called the Nephilim.
Yeah, Nephilim, right. Yeah, aren't they cute? And Nephilim are the fallen, the dropped angels, the angels that dropped.
Right.
And they're Uzzah and Uzzael, who were two angels. Why do you think, you know, if you read in the book of Leviticus, in the Old Testament, in the Torah, you'll see that on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the high priest sacrificed two goats in two different ways. One was its spirit was released, meaning it was killed on the altar, and the other goat was sent out with a desert person way out into the desert across seven canyons to the place where Uzzah and Azazel live, the two fallen angels, remaining fallen angels, the two remaining Nephilim. So we offered a sacrifice to the two fallen angels. There's a whole lot to talk about that, my God. But basically, what the oral tradition of our people tells us about this, because you can't understand the written tradition without the oral, and that's what a lot of people who are not of our faith don't understand. So they just read the literal Holy Bible in the desk drawer of the night table of the Super 8 Motel, and they don't have the whole picture to it. So the oral tradition tells us that what happened was that the angels did not want, they were dead set against God creating humans, because they knew that the humans would upset everything. They'd destroy the world. They would upset the ecosystem. They would mess everything up. They would distort the psychology of the animal world. They would do everything wrong. And God said, well, it's still my intent to make them. So stay out of my business. And then two angels, Uzzah and Uzzael, came to God and said, if we were down there, if you sent angels to live on your earth, we would do it so much better than humans. And God said, no, you wouldn't. And they said, yes, we would. No, you wouldn't. Yes, we would. So finally, God said, okay. And so they would drop down here. That's why they're called the Nephilim, the fallen angels. Not that they fell from grace, like people read it, but they dropped from the heavens as a dare, and they failed abysmally. And that's when the big flood came, because a lot of corruption happened that came out of them, and so on and so forth. So to this day, the Zohar tells us, the ancient writings of the Zohar tell us that the fallen angels, the Nephilim, they still live today. They live forever. They live deep down in the deep, unfathomable, deep canyons of the Judean desert where no one can go. And there, what do? They impart airwaves, not earwigs, they impart airwaves of sorcery wisdom to corrupt and to bless. So those who use their wisdom properly create blessing in the world through their sorcery wisdom, and those who seek to corrupt the world will find ample power in that sorcery wisdom.
What is the role of good and evil in the Kabbalah?
The role of good. good and evil in the Kabbalah is to create the tension of opposites, which creates at the same time either the distortion or the harmonization of spirit and matter. The role of good and evil in the world is to challenge, is to create the greatest gift that the Creator wished to impart, which is self. I cannot experience myself as a unique self if I am a puppet, if I'm not challenged. Meaning, if I never experienced bad, I would never know or appreciate good. If I never hurt, I would never be able to appreciate not hurting. If I was never hungry, I would never appreciate food. See? So all of the opposites that were created by the same God who created the opposites are there in order to create a very sacred tension within us by which we develop a unique self. And we become individuals. We become actual beings, not parroting life, but actually creating life. We become co-creators. We become co-participators in existence. We become choice makers. When God walks with Enoch, it says in the so-called Old Testament, God walks with Noah. But when it came to the father Abraham, God says to him, "Hitalech lefonai ve'yetamim," walk in front of me. That's the challenge. The challenge is to not know for sure where the hell we're going, where the road goes. Where did the road go? Where did the road go? That's the challenge. The challenge is, and what is it that challenges us to take the step, whether it's right or wrong, but to take a step, to do our best in choice making? That is the tension of what we call good and what we call evil. And that's what God said to Isaiah, the prophet, in an interview. Isaiah interviewed God a lot on CNN. And God said to Isaiah, I am the God who created light and I created darkness. I created good and I created evil. I created peace and I created evil, that is. I am God who made all of that. You know, like King Solomon said, in between making love to his 1,000 wives, he managed to say some wise things like, "Gamzelu mazeh osolohim." I'm just making up the Hebrew, Sariah. Which means, this two opposite the other did God create. Because it is, the oppositeness is the sacred challenge. The oppositeness of feminine and masculine is a sacred challenge. Can a masculine and feminine being actually unify and come together? Can the feminine see the masculine for what the masculine is instead of using only the feminine perspective? Can the masculine see the feminine for what the feminine is instead of only using the masculine perspective? That is the great challenge. Can good see evil and see the good? Or can evil see good and see the evil in the good? Anybody can go and become somebody completely opposite of who they are today. And that's why, you know, when people come to me and say, you know, a man and a woman come to me, they want to get married, or a man and a man come to me, they want to get married, or a woman come to me, get married, I say to them, "Why do you ever want to be with this person? Why? This is a whole different self, and you're a whole different self. Stop it. Go away. Go your separate ways and leave me alone. What's the matter with you? Why do you may want to make trouble? Don't you want peace in your life?" Because that's the challenge. The challenge is, are you really willing to take this risk? Are you willing to enter the Holy of Holies and make love to each other, and meaning not just in sex and bed, but also it means that each of you will strive to see the other, not through your lenses, but through the other's lenses, and to honor the other as other, not to honor the other as long as the other, does whatever you want to do. The tendency is to treat everybody in our own image, and that is very wrong, and that's what the tension of the good and evil is all about. That's why Adam and Eve You know, they were standing there at the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and they had no idea what to do because they were standing there stark naked and bored out of their wits. They had no idea of what happiness was because they'd never felt sad. They had no idea what health was because they'd never felt sick. So they had no idea of nothing. They had no knowledge. So God finally sent the snake and said, "Look, snake, go do your job, will you? Get these people out of my garden. They're bored and they're boring me." Huh. And so they ate of the tree, and they ate of the tree, and they entered the realm of and, this and the other, and the tension of it, and overwhelmed them. And from then on, we can test this as a mythology about the story of the human struggle within and without. The struggle of good and evil is the struggle of God and evil.
All right. Well, you're on WVBR FM Ithaca. We're almost out of time. I'm definitely going to have to have you come back on because there's a lot more stuff I'd like to talk to you about.
Okie doke.
And how many books have you written?
I've written 14 books, I think. Yeah, 14 books.
Okay, and the most recent is what?
The most recent is Daily Kabbalah, where I translated a lot of the lesser known Kabbalistic writings and into a readable English, an accessible English. So there's like for every day of the year, a little short paragraph to read about something really beautiful, really, really sweet and inspiring, and maybe even funny sometimes.
All right. And your website again?
My website is walkingstick1word.org.
And Miriam's?
Is miriamscyberwell.com.
All right, and they're both linked on wheredidtheroadgo.com, so people can just go there and click on them. And
thank you.
I thank you for such a deep and revealing interview. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that have no idea this stuff exists in Judaism.
Yeah, they probably have no idea what the hell I was talking about either.
I suspect they will.
But that's part of the program. You know, where does the road end? Where does it go? Where do they go?
Exactly.
I love the title of your program.
Well, thank you.
Really.
All right. We're going to hear one more song from Miriam. And this is Merkava?
Well, this is called the Merkava. Well, this is a very beautiful Kabbalistic prayer where the person, you know, is very old. And the words mean, "I am ready to accept upon myself to become the vehicle for the Shekhinah, which is the feminine indwelling, the feminine presence of the divine in my life."
All right.
It's a beautiful, beautiful chant.
All right. And coming up next is The Last Exit for the Lost. We have James Swagger on again with us next week, talking about his trip to Peru, investigating ancient sites, and his ayahuasca experience. And I thank you, Gershon. It's been a pleasure.
And I thank you, Sarai. You have a really beautiful evening up there.
And here we go. This is Miriam? Miriam Marion? Is that it?
Miriam Maron, yes.
Okay.
Merkava.
It's me. Shift.